This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Last week, the landscape of the telecommunications industry shifted dramatically. On Monday, the Walt Disney Company announced plans to buy ABC. This merger will make Disney the largest entertainment company in the world and the first media company to have a major presence in four distribution systems: film, broadcasting, cable television, and telephone lines. On Tuesday, Westinghouse announced they are buying CBS. And on Friday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation that would ease many restrictions on broadcasting, cable, and phone companies. Supporters of this legislation believe that it will lead to more services and lower prices. Critics are afraid it will allow cable rates to rise and encourage the formation of huge media conglomerates. 12 years ago, in his book, The Media Monopoly, my guest, Ben Bagdikian, warned of the dangers of the concentration of the media to a democratic society. Bagdikian has had a long career as a newspaper reporter and as the former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. He has a new memoir called Double Vision. I asked Ben Bagdikian about what he foresees with these mergers.
Well, for one thing, in a generalized way, it means that there were fewer and fewer very powerful organizations that will decide what the country will see and hear. And because they're all after the same thing, a single huge audience, which is quite natural because that's what the advertisers would like, and something that is exportable because half of, for example, movie revenues come from abroad, that where does that leave the need of the public to understand the country's issues, its problems, the various solutions? Those tend to get lost. And I think it's very troublesome for the ability of the country to understand its problems, including where these big corporate developments fit into the whole scheme. And the problem, I think, is not that the people who are putting these things together and the big mergers are evil. They're just doing what comes naturally. But what comes naturally is what used to in the 19th century, when there was no income tax, there was no government regulation, was produce a huge depression every 4 years. And I think we are slow learners in that way.
Is there any evidence, though, that the advertising department is intruding itself into the editorial department in these major media conglomerates?
Well, I know from anecdotal things I hear from reporters that, yes, that shows up that way. But the biggest problem, I think, is less that, because we do have journalism reviews that discover this and embarrass the companies from time to time. But I think the big problem is that it's, again, what the news looks at and whom it listens to. And one of the problems is that most journalists spend most of their time talking to the movers and shakers of society, which is important, but don't spend much time talking to those who are moved and shaken. And after all, the whole purpose of national policies ought to be for the economic and social health and justice for as many people in the country as possible, not just those who are avid watchers of the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Was there a time, though, in journalism when reporters and their bosses were interested in the little guy, the little gal, and their story?
Well, it's easy to romanticize that, but if you go back far enough, yes, there were powerful publishers, Pulitzer in the 19th century, Hearst in his beginnings, who were the very powerful spokespersons for the little guy, for factory condition reforms, for treating labor decently. But as the news became a big business over the years, that began to disappear. And so it's carried on by the smaller publications, the weeklies. It's carried on to a great extent by public broadcasting. And so you can romanticize the past, but in fact, there was more diversity. When you could buy four or five newspapers in every city of any size, some of them sought out that part of the population whose concerns and interests were not being met by other papers.
What does it mean, then, if there are more national publications or more national broadcast services and fewer and fewer local newspapers or small-town radio stations? What does that mean for the consumer?
It means a great deal because, you know, unlike most developed countries, the United States leaves very important functions of government to the local voters, to the geographic communities, not the cyberspace community. We vote to decide what our schools will be like. We vote to see what our police will do. We vote to what will happen, how do we use our land and form our neighborhoods. And they don't do that in most other countries. That's a big national bureaucracy. And so we need that information. And so what it does, when you begin to diminish that as part of our regular news, is it leaves most of the public bewildered about the things that are happening to them, because they don't see any reflection of it that it makes sense to them. And it also leaves us much poorer in various ideas, alternatives for meeting our problems. So we begin to see very small spectrum of solutions to our problems that don't seem to apply very well to the whole scene. So yes, there's a very real cost to that, and I think it leads to malaise in society. Eventually it leads to disorder in society because people get discouraged. They don't understand the problems that are making their life more difficult, and they don't understand the possibilities for remedies.
In your book, The Media Monopoly, you call for genuine competition. You call for more diversity. Do you see things like cable access, C-SPAN, the internet, zines, which are homegrown magazines, even talk radio, as genuine competition for the kind of major conglomerate-type media outlets?
Well, I think they could be, but they aren't happening that way. For example, because the Fairness Doctrine was repealed, it means that any group or individual who's attacked by a powerful person on radio, which happens daily, has no recourse. They can't go to the broadcaster and say, listen, the Communications Act says you've got to operate in the public interest, and the Fairness Doctrine says that if I'm attacked, you've got to give me a chance to reply. Well, that doesn't exist anymore because they deregulated that. And so that what we have, for example, if you take, say, talk radio, overwhelmingly right-wing, very conservative talk radio, increasingly almost every year, and no need of broadcasters to let those who feel differently or who've been attacked to respond. I mean, that's simply unfair. And what's happening is that the supposed magic answer, which is computers and internet and cyberspace, that's a person-to-person communication. We live by geographical voting communities. We live with real neighbors, even if we may not see them on the sidewalk every day. And unless we have an understanding of each other in the communities we live in, and we not only hear, we come to expect and tolerate differences, then I think we're in serious trouble.
I'm curious, though, why you think the press is criticized for being liberal when there's so much corporate conservative ownership and control?
Well, it's one of the ironies. That's always been true. And I think the reason is that journalists, if they're any good at all, look not just at the surface of things, but try to look behind the surface. They're very conscious that public relations is an inherent part of making powerful entities look good, and whether it's politics or corporate life. And they try to check out how much is surface appearance and how much is reality. And when you look behind that, you find that much of what is presented to the general public has flaws in it. And if you point out those flaws, you seem to be doing something improper. So when powerful people, who by and large, with obvious exceptions, tend to be conservative, see that this conservative picture of the world has other elements in the description that are not necessarily going to make them happy, they say, aha, the world is as I see it, and here the journalist presenting something other than that, and that's because they're a bunch of liberals and radicals. And I think, you know, it is to laugh, I think.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first let's take a very short break. And my guest is Ben Bagdikian, a veteran journalist and was the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, also was at the Washington Post, in fact, was instrumental in the Washington Post decision to publish the Pentagon Papers, was also at the Providence Journal, author of a book that came out in the 80s called The Media Monopoly, and now the author of a memoir called Double Vision. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest today on Fresh Air is journalist Ben Bagdikian. Well, let me get your perspective about how you think news has changed since World War II, or I guess just from before World War II, when you really began your work as a journalist. How is it look different, sound different, even smell different in the newsroom?
Well, you know, in the book, The Double Vision, I describe the newsroom where I first went to work in Springfield, Massachusetts. And practically everybody smoked. They wore green eye shades. The cigarette burns on all the desks and on the floor. Reporters cursed in very colorful language.
There weren't too many women around, right?
There were women, but they were probably segregated in what was called the social section. They wrote about the T's held by the great of the city. And there was a telegraph operator who used a Morse key to get the late stock market and sports cores. You could hear the chugging of the teletypes, and there was smoke over everything. It was a factory, exciting factory. Now, but when I joined that staff, I learned very quickly that if you had gone to college, you kept your mouth shut about it. Because there were a large number of reporters, some of them very good, who had not gone to college, but there was a general feeling that a young kid who had gone to college had his brain scrambled and was not fit to understand real life.
Well,
today, if you go into a newsroom of any size, they look like a bunch of graduate students working on their dissertation. There's carpeting on the floor. Nobody smokes. If someone brought in a brass spittoon, which was all over the floors of the, the Springfield Morning Union, someone would say, "What's that?" And some old geezer with a good memory would like to say, "Well, I say that's something people used to smoke cigars and spit a lot."
Okay. You talk about the skills needed when you were starting out was to, quote, walk fast, talk fast, type fast, and never break a deadline. Was that the kind of thrill that you had as a young reporter starting out to be able to get to the news so fast and to work under that kind of frenetic pace?
Yeah, it was very exciting. Plus, something that's personal, not true of everybody, but I think true of quite a few other journalists. I'm by nature a timid person socially. I still am, but I can fake it. But what happens when you're a reporter is that you have a kind of license to be in the presence of the great, to get into places of power, to talk to the mayor, the governor, the president of the United States, to the head of a company, to distinguished scientists, which you would never do as an ordinary citizen. Not only could you not get past the secretaries, but you wouldn't want to do it because you'd feel uneasy. What are you doing there? But as a reporter, in the United States, it's not true in all countries, but in the United States, you have a kind of acceptance to be in the presence of people who have power to ask them questions. And that's terribly exciting. And to me, what was increased the excitement was it also let me see the other less glamorous parts of life. So I got a picture of, when I did stories about the poor, I lived in flop houses. I picked beans in Florida. When I did a story about prisons and jails, I spent some time in prison, and I began to see it from there. And it's a compelling kind of life, and I loved it. And I would do it all over again if I were starting at the age of 20.
Your memoir is called Double Vision, and you write about the fact that to be a reporter, to be a journalist, you need to have a kind of double vision to be both an insider and an outsider. And looking at your life, it's really been a life that has, for better or for worse, provided you with a kind of double vision because of the fact that your family had to flee Turkey and come to this country as immigrants.
You know, I think it made a huge difference. And, you know, I was kind of dumb about all that for a long time. We journalists operate on the doctrine of objectivity, which is very useful. You don't cheat on the facts. But the longer I was a journalist, the more I realized that what I found myself looking at most and what impressed me most in the scenes I was looking at had a great deal to do with my own life experience. It had something to do with my being an Armenian, growing up in a New England town outside of Boston, of having a Calvinistic father who believed if you kissed a girl, you married her, but also the man that was, I think, the warmest, most loving person in my life, my Uncle Fred, who was a mechanic and truck driver. And all those things went into my view of life and what I saw as the good life. And so when I had choices, I was attracted to, without thinking about it, looking at certain parts of our society. So what I did in my life had something to do with my being an Armenian, but it also had something to do with growing up in New England with all of the New England influences, which includes a certain amount of self-righteousness, and maybe that's why I'm a media critic, too.
Well, you write about your family's escape from Turkey, and I mean, write in the most chilling kind of terms. And actually, if you could even describe for us what it was to try to get out of that country and the fact that your father thought you were dead, and you were, I guess, about 4 months old when they finally got out of the country, but they nearly gave you up for dead.
Yes, it required, because the after World War I, that Turkey was a part of the defeated Axis, the defeated alliance with Germany, it was occupied by the British and French. And after the war, they began vacating it in order to get back to normal, which meant making deals for the Middle East, which meant dealing with the new Turkish government. And they began withdrawing their troops. And when they did, of course, the Armenians, who had already suffered extermination of half of the existing Armenians during the World War I, had to escape or else be slaughtered by the Turks, who were then taking back their cities. And so my family, my father was a leader in that community. He'd been a professor. I had four older sisters, ages 5 to 13, and I had just been born. And my mother and father had to escape 5 days over the frozen mountains in February.
And this was a terrible blizzard going on.
Terrible, and thousands of people died of freezing to death, including some of the American missionaries who were there. And at one point, it looked as though, to my father, that I had died. And he just carried me as a bundle under his arm. There was no place to bury me because of the snow and frozen ground. And also, he told me later that there was no time to tell the family this because they would be demoralized already. And so then my mother, who was riding the one horse that we had over the mountains because she had just given birth, began to faint and fall off the horse. And he dropped the bundle, me, to grab my mother. And when I hit the ground, I cried. So presumably, if it hadn't been for that incident, I probably would have died of, in the mountains north of Maraş, Turkey.
Did your family talk much about this chapter in your life? And your mother, once you came to the States, your mother died from TB. You were about 4 years old. And your memories of her as being a very sickly woman. Was there much talk about this past in Turkey?
Well, I think, we had gatherings, wonderful gatherings of my friends, of my father's friends and relatives. And they were great storytellers, but there were bits of these horror stories, but not many. I think that mostly if there was talk of it, there were either the miraculous escapes or very funny stories, because I think there's something in the human psyche that does not dwell on horror very long because it's not something one can do very long without its twisting them. So that I heard bits and pieces. And I have a sister, my sister Lydia, who died a couple of years ago, had written in her notebook, typically 400 neatly typed pages. And when I read it, it sort of swept me off my feet. And it was one of the things that led me to write this memoir.
Well, do you think being a newcomer, being an immigrant, helped you as a journalist in a being an outsider, looking in.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that it made a difference. That doesn't mean you have to be an immigrant to be a good journalist or to be an excited one, but it means that I think unless you have, if you have tasted, if you have experienced the variations and extremes in some of your life, it seems to me you are more sensitized to the fact that this is true for most people, and that it is these variations and these extremes that make reporting and make life in general a dynamic, interesting experience. And so, yes, I think that did help. But then non-immigrants have those kinds of things. I used to, of course, when I was a kid growing up in Stoneham, Massachusetts, I wanted more than anything else to be called Bill Summers and to look like Clark Gable, and I would stand in front of the mirror, and I would do everything I could to have that debonair sneer of Clark Gable, and then I'd look sideways, and there I was. I couldn't get away from it. You wanted to be a WASP more than anything else in the world, but eventually you have to come to grips with the fact that you ain't.
And that's okay, right?
And then you think that if you were a WASP, life would be like the people you saw who knew which fork to pick up at a fancy banquet and who had a wonderful life of order, the kinds of things in the advertisements in the National Geographic, and they dressed in tuxedos for dinner. And then you discover when you get good friends among WASPs that they have the same kinds of conflicts traumas and conflicts in their lives. And I think this sort of thing makes good journalists, the ones who have experienced things that force them to be sensitized to the vicissitudes of life. And not just the vicissitudes, the joyful differences that exist. And all of that, I think, does go into making a better journalist.
Well, Ben Magdikian, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air. I really appreciate the conversation. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Veteran journalist Ben Magdikian is the author of Double Vision. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.